The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
But transplanted for the last 17 years into the Los Angeles area. I live on the far north side of L.A. County in the mountains. I teach at a little liberal arts college out there. And between me, I live at the edge of the National Forest on the north side of the L.A. Basin. Between where I live and the border of Mexico, which you could drive to in about 2.5 hours if there was no traffic, but there's always about a week's worth of traffic between L.A. and San Diego. Between where I live and the bottom of San Diego, the border of Mexico, live 35 million people. One out of 10 people in the United States lives in that area of Southern California. 35 million people. We have three classical schools that are up and running. Just three. The one that I helped start, high school. Another one, great school down near San Diego called Cambridge. And another one that's been kind of limping around a little bit. I don't really know of any others. I would like to ask you all to be thinking and praying about God moving to start 10 classical schools in that area in the next 10 years. It's very doable. 35 million people. There are believers in California, believe it or not. There is money. Everything, unfortunately, is very, very, very expensive, and it can be a very difficult place to live. But I want to see this movement spread into and take over Southern California. That's what I would like to see. Because I live 10 minutes from Hollywood, and that is the cultural production capital of the planet. Everybody gets all of their ideas about how they think about everything from Hollywood. And we need Christians surrounding and, in a certain sense, taking over that place. I get invited to speak a lot of places once, so we'll see if that is what happens here. A lot of people don't really take my talk seriously. I'm not sure why. Sometimes it takes a few minutes for this to sink in and people to make the kind of visual pun connection. Because we're going to be talking about Plato and Socrates and the Socratic method today. Central to authentically classical teaching is Socratic dialogue. Put your hand up if you've ever done it or tried to do it or do it on a regular basis. Probably a great many of you. Do that. It's a major attraction, I think, for parents and for students considering classical education. And it's a core reason that highly motivated and serious intellectuals love working in these kind of institutions. Much more interesting than most of what goes on in most colleges and graduate schools. The drudgery and the boredom and the ineffectiveness of so many other teaching styles and systems really stultifies both the teachers and the students. The teachers are often as bored as the students are in what passes for education in 20th and 21st century. Classical pedagogy invigorates and inflames them with a passion for learning. Now, when I ask people to give me a definition of Socratic dialogue, even seasoned teachers will sometimes find themselves at a loss. I hear variations of, well, we read Hamlet, and then we sit around a round table called a Harkness or something, and then we just talk about it. I don't lecture, I don't use PowerPoint, I don't give handouts. We just talk, and so that's Socratic, right? And what actually happens is we describe the event instead of thinking through theoretically what is going on and why it does seem to work. Why Socratic dialogue seems to work. Certainly very few of us run discourses and run classrooms the way that Socrates did, otherwise most of us would be having hemlock tea. where someone is led down a garden path by this kind of slightly ironic, really ugly old guy that asks increasingly annoying questions, some master spirit who helps you to discover the depths of your ignorance, which are unfolded in front of you. This is a particularly unhelpful tactic when you're talking about, like, tuition raises with potential students and parents and so on and so forth. So we can kind of look at the basic idea of Socratic dialogue through the words of a couple of Plato scholars. One guy says, elenchus, which is kind of the word that is used to describe Socratic dialogue, Socratic questioning, Socratic method. Elenchus, though painful, is supposed to have beneficial effects upon the soul of its victim. I mean, that's kind of, it's interesting they use the word victim there, right? It's supposed to help you, but it kind of hurts. It's like buying a gym membership. You know, wait, I give you money, and then you yell at me while I lift heavy things? How does that work? This doesn't make a lot of sense. But, another Plato scholar says, scholars call Socrates' method the elenchus, which is Hellenistic Greek for inquiry or cross-examination. Sounds like you're, you know, on trial for a parking ticket or something. But it is not just any type of inquiry or examination. It is a type that reveals people to themselves. That's the idea behind the elenchus or the Socratic dialogue. And of course, everybody knows, certainly in a conference like this, that Socrates, in many ways, the father of Socrates, and of course, Plato, who was Socrates' student, and then his student was Aristotle, and so you guys all know that little genealogy of Western philosophy. I always confuse Socrates and Plato, because Socrates didn't really write anything down, as far as we know. Plato wrote down the Socratic dialogues, and so we know Socrates through Plato. So just to keep it straight in my head, I just refer to them as Socrates. It's just much, much easier for me to just say Socrates, because you get confused. How many of you are in a classical school that does not have a poster of this somewhere on the wall? Okay, that's like a membership requirement for ACCS. Well, you have to get one, otherwise you're not classical. Come on, right? Okay, I was here a week and a half ago. I've been in Rome twice in the last 2 months. I'm still kind of on Italy time right now. So if I start speaking in Italian, just put your hand up and go, please, we don't need that. So, of course, we have Socrates right there in the back, and just to the left, in that last little arch, and off to the side next to him is Aristotle. Socrates is, Plato, really, not Socrates, is pointing up because he's an idealist, and he's carrying his copy of the Timaeus, which is kind of a Greek philosophical work that apparently was written under the influence of LSD. And then Aristotle is pointing down. No, it's not. He's not a downer. He's not like a surfer on a bad day in Ventura. No, dude, the waves are not rolling today, man. We're going to go and get tacos. Right. So Aristotle, he's kind of the realist. Now, what's real, what's here, that's what's important. He's holding his copy of Nicomachean Ethics. So everybody has this stuff. It's kind of circulating and floating around in our culture. But the problem is that it can be a hard sell to talk to Christians, to talk to people who are trying to be conservative, orthodox, biblical, generally kind of Protestant, kind of reformed Christians, generally pretty conservative people culturally, and say, and we're going to do this classical thing too, and our methodology is Socratic dialogue. And I go, wait a minute, that's pagan, isn't it? That's the problem. It can be a real hard sell. How many times have we heard this? Socrates was a pagan. Why use the Socratic method of asking questions? Why don't we just tell the kids what to think? Right? Why don't we just do that? You toss in a little bit of problematic pagan content, a little bit of Ovid. Anybody? Anybody have any of those parents' conference calls about Ovid? Oh, you got my kid reading Ovid. This is terrible stuff, right? And then you've got a really serious recruiting and retention problem. It's very problematic. Remember the question that Tertullian asked, right? What has Athens to say to Jerusalem? What do the pagans have to say to the believers in the one true God? And can they charge us tuition? Right? See, that's the problem, because if it's a Christian education, can it also be classical? And if it's classical, can it be Christian? Can you hybridize those? Should you? Do you really want to do that? Right? And if we have a conversation about that issue, is it going to be a Socratic discussion? Or am I just going to tell you what to think? Right? So we would indeed be wise to ask, how Christian or biblical is Socratic discussion exactly? Did Jesus use it? Did he simply imitate a Greek philosopher and preceded him? I don't know, Thomas, what do you think? Did Jesus claim, like Socrates, to only know that he knew nothing? Uh-uh. Both Jesus and Socrates as historical figures showed with revelatory efficiency that none of us know what we think we know. And while there are certain parallels between Christ and Socrates, there are far more differences and similarities, particularly the ultimate one. After he drank the hemlock, Socrates stayed dead. So why would we use something as pagan as a Socratic method, as a pedagogical tool, particularly a central one? So the question has to be asked, is education which is classical also Christian? Why use content and methodology that is derived even in part from darkened minds? This question is beyond the scope of a 45-minute or an hour-long talk. But what I want to do is I want to talk to you a little bit about what Socratic dialogue is and how it works. And this will actually kind of feed into the two other talks I'm going to be doing tomorrow morning and then a plenary on Saturday. One of the most common defenses that you hear for classical Christian education goes like this, and it comes right out of Reformed apologetics. It's very Van Til apologetic kind of stuff. And it goes like this. All truth is God's truth. Even pagan culture functions under God's rule, including pagan worldviews, belief systems, and cultural tropes. These cultural expressions are all partial. They're all shadowy imitations and weak reflections, you know, reflection of Doug Wilson over here, right? Okay, shadowy, weak reflections, imitations of God's ultimate truth. And thus, pagan content and even methodology are worthy of study, and they are of some use to Christians. Now, it doesn't take a particularly keen intellect to recognize that that argument is, at its core, in both content and form, Platonic. Oh, all pagan content is a shadowy reflection of the truth. That's Platonism, you understand. And so it could be seen perhaps as a very weak apologetic for a classical Christian education. A skeptic would say that the premises are already contained in your conclusion. You're only doing classical stuff because you like Virgil. And you're probably a Platonist Christian instead of a biblical Christian. As I remind my students, undergraduate and graduate students all the time, just remember that Platonist rhymes with Satanist, but we're not going to go down there, right? You would say, a skeptic would say, that paganism has already infected classical Christian education at the level of foundational justification. But you could still mount a similar critique from the other side, saying that that argument is built upon an unproven assumption that there's no value in studying pagan conception of the world, and so you end up with a stalemate. And if you run a school or you teach, particularly in the humanities, and you work with parents who have some concerns, particularly about content issues, they don't usually think about methodology, then you've probably dealt with this question. I know that I have. And that brings me to my thesis that there is, in fact, a biblical theological reason why Socratic dialogue is so incredibly effective and why Christians should utilize it in an educational setting. So that's my thesis, that there is a theological, biblical reason that Socratic dialogue works and can be justified for use in a Christian school. But first of all, what exactly is this classical pagan theory behind Socratic dialogue? It just didn't spring into being like Athena out of Zeus's head or anything like that. Surprisingly, most of the people who use Socratic dialogue, or even people who talk about it and don't use it, don't know where it came from, and they don't understand what the worldview is behind it. They think, well, I don't know, Socrates is just a dude that liked to ask annoying questions and get beat up, you know? And they think that's always. But if we take a brief look at a couple of classical texts, we will quickly find out that there is an entire superstructure, a very interesting worldview behind the entire system of what is called Platonic dialogue or Socratic dialogue, Socratic method, Socratic questioning, or the Elenchus. Right? Cicero has this wonderful little book called De Senectute. It's increasingly becoming one of my favorites since I have a bunch of grandkids and a white beard and no hair on the top of my head now, called De Senectute. It's written in 44 BC. It's typically beautiful Ciceronian Latin. And it's just a wonderful book, basically written as a kind of like a letter dialogue. And it talks about senectitude, or growing old. And the problems with that, especially in the ancient world where they didn't have ibuprofen and things like that, and then all the wonderful things about growing old. And in this wonderful Ciceronian book, we find this. Cicero says at one point, "And a strong argument that men's knowledge of numerous things antedates their birth. They have the knowledge before they're born. Is the fact that mere children in studying difficult subjects so quickly lay hold upon innumerable things," this would not include algebra, at least in my experience, "that they seem not to be then learning them for the first time, but to be recalling and remembering them." This, in substance, is Plato's teaching. That's what Cicero says. Cicero says this idea that kids learn things as rapidly as they do because they're not really learning them. It's not something new that they're beginning to systematize and categorize in their minds. They are recalling and remembering something they already knew, even though they're little tykes. Right? And he says that's Plato's doctrine. Right? So his explanation for this is very, very, Very interesting. Cicero, also in other works, the Meno and the Phaedo, and to a lesser extent the Phaedrus, says basically the same thing. And this educative remembering or recalling of something that you already know, as opposed to learning something entirely new, that's called anamnesis. A-N-A-M-N-E-S-I-S. Anamnesis. We're going to talk about that in a moment, and I'll have a slide up there so you can see how to spell it. If, like me, you're not really a naturally good speller. Etymologically, anamnesis suggests not remembering. Not remembering. What we would call, maybe in English, translate it as the not forgetting. Because not remembering is forgetting. And so not remembering would be the not forgetting. Or better, remembering. Okay. Let's keep things simple here. Right? If we can, you know, keep the number of prefixes below 6, that's always helpful, I find. Okay. The Greek and Latin prefixes, it's kind of a double negation before the root for remember, mnesis. It's significant. The words form anamnesis with a negating prefix and then another negating prefix, and then mnesis, the root, right, to remember, remembering, remembrance, memory. The word's form is a roadmap of its function. In the Platonic and Socratic conception, learning is an unforgetting. Learning is an unforgetting. You knew something. You forgot it. It was brought back into your consciousness. Who brought it back? A teacher asking questions. That's the basic idea behind Socratic method. Now, if we take a look at another one of the great classical writers, one of my all-time favorites, Virgil, in the Aeneid, book 6. How many of you have read Virgil here? At least some Virgil. Virgil's one. If you haven't read Virgil, go out and get Fagel's translation right now and read the Aeneid. Did you know whose favorite book it was? He died while he was working on a translation for it. I hung out with his best friend, Walter Hooper, when I was lecturing in Oxford. And little Walter Hooper, who was C.S. Lewis's best friend, said, "Do you know what Professor Lewis's favorite book was?" And I was like, "The Bible? You know, Paradise Lost?" And no. The Aeneid, and he told me, you know, and Lewis was working on a translation he didn't finish. That Hooper actually published it. It's actually pretty good. It's only about 30% done, I think. Okay, but the Aeneid is fabulous, and Virgil's Latin is gorgeous. And in book 6, like all great epic heroes, Virgil's hero Aeneas, the Trojan founder of Rome, who kind of models the journey of Homer's Odysseus, goes into the underworld, led by the Cimmerian Sibyl, and he goes down there to get advice from his dead father Anchises about how do I fulfill all these prophecies and become the founder of Rome. I can't even find the bloody place on the map because it's not really there yet. Right? And so what happens is we get this passage. Aeneas' dead father's shade, Anchises, is describing to Aeneas everything that he sees in the underworld. Right? And Aeneas sees this long line of people, and they're all lined up, and they're headed somewhere, right? And along the way, they're stopping, and they're drinking from this river, Lethe. And this is what Anchises says. After you've been down in the underworld for 1,000 years, but when 1,000 rolling years are past, so long their punishments and penance last, whole droves of minds are, by the driving god, compelled to drink the deep Lethean flood. What happens when you drink from the river Lethe? Makes you forget, because Lethe means forget in classical Greek, right? The deep Lethean flood, you drink it and you're just like, I don't even know what I'm doing here. Right? In large forgetful draughts to steep the cares of their past labors and their irksome years, that unremembering of its former pain, the soul may suffer mortal flesh again. See, there's a lot of different theories as to why the gods would force people in the underworld to drink from the river Lethe and forget things. Part of it is that the idea is that you're going to be reborn again, and to leave the underworld, if you were in Tartarus, which is a bad place, you would want to leave. But if you were in the good place, if you'd been a good person, if you're in Elysium, you didn't want to leave. And so they would have you drink from Lethe so that you would forget how miserable it was to be reborn. You might be reborn where I live, in Los Angeles, and be an unattractive person. That would be worse than being in Tartarus. Right? And so what happens is we see this same idea of learning through a series of lifetimes
and then forgetting it by drinking Lethe in the pagan world in the narrative form in Virgil's Aeneid, right? And so what happens is, Aeneas goes down into the underworld and he has this very awkward encounter with Dido. You know, Dido, who committed suicide because, you know, Aeneas, you know, left her. And he doesn't know she's committed suicide. And he comes around a corner and down in the underworld. He's like, oh, Dido, what are you doing here? You. Yeah. She doesn't say anything. She gives, T.S. Eliot calls it the greatest snub in all of literary history. Right? Aeneas is like, so, baby, what's up? Yeah, you know, I'm sorry I didn't text you back, but, like, my phone died and I got this new plan and it just doesn't get reception down here and I don't know what's going on. And what does she do? She just... And she just walks away, right? Which in the ancient world was the only thing you could do. Right? So the question becomes this. Aeneas sees this massive throng of people flooding past Lethe and drinking it. And they're flooding towards a gate. And the gate leaves the underworld. And of course, they're all going to be reborn, is the idea. Right? And the question becomes, why would you leave Elysium? The place for the good people, the philosophical people, the ethical people, the moral people. What's the first thing Aeneas sees people doing when he gets to Elysium? It's the ultimate Greek pleasure, wrestling. That's what they're doing, because wrestling is the coolest sport of all, and the Greeks love it. So when you go to Elysium, you get to wrestle people. Right? So Elysium is this place of pleasure and joy and rewards for all your good deeds and so on and so forth. Why would you want to leave pleasurable Elysium for another round of human tribulations? Why would you be reborn in a body that would get sick and would get old and would ache and would suffer with unfulfilled desires? Why would you go back? That's why the gods have you drink from Lethe, so you forget what it's like to leave Elysium and go back into a world of tribulation. Okay? Anchises explains to his son Aeneas that the souls are continually reincarnated until they reach perfection. You thought that the Hindus invented that. It's Greek. It is a Greek conception. After death, souls that were relatively bad go to Tartarus to be purged of evil habits and deeds. Relatively good souls enjoy Elysium temporarily, but they must eventually return to the world to live better and better lives with each incarnation. Progressive sanctification, you might call that. I call that bad theology, but they were Greek, you know, you can't expect that kind of stuff, right? And Anchises then shows Aeneas a long line of souls awaiting rebirth. And these are his Trojan ancestors waiting to be reborn as his Roman descendants. He's watching his past become his future. And he's the central link, right? He's the link between the Trojan past and the Roman future. He's the last Trojan, and he's the first Roman, and he's watching his past become his future. And Anchises tells Aeneas that he is going to be reborn as Marcellus, right? Now, what's interesting is Marcellus is an actual Roman figure, and according to Suetonius, Roman historian, when Virgil was reading his, you know, handwritten copy of his new book, The Aeneid, about the founding of Rome, at the court of Caesar Augustus, Caesar Augustus' sister, Octavia, her son, Marcellus, had some months before been killed in a battle for the glory of Rome. And when Virgil gets to reading this part, according to Suetonius, and says, Aeneas, your next reincarnation, you are going to be reborn as Marcellus. Aeneas, the founder of Rome, the ultimate Roman, the original Roman, the greatest of all Romans, is going to be reborn as Marcellus. Octavia fainted. Because her son had recently died. And mythologically, he is the reincarnation of Aeneas. So, why, when a soul is reborn, would we be reborn as ignorant blank slates? Because that's what the Platonic doctrine teaches. That's because you drank from the river Lethe. You live a life, you live a whole bunch of lives, you learn all this. Could you imagine how much easier it would be if you just had a whole lot of lifetimes to learn all the how to make a left turn in L.A. at 5 o'clock? You know, how to deal with a DMV, how to raise kids. Well, imagine if you had all these lifetimes. You only get one. Imagine if you had all these lifetimes to learn all the things that you need to learn. But then you go into the underworld and you have to drink Lethe. And what happens to all that knowledge and wisdom? You forget it. And so you're born like a little baby. You're a blank slate. Tabula rasa, to quote Locke. The combination of the birth, according to the Greeks, the combination of the birth trauma and the drinking of the Lethe that causes you to forget everything you learned in your previous lives, right? I mean, you drink the river Lethe, that's bad enough, but your first experience as a new person is some woman you've never met going, I did it out! Well, of course you're traumatized. You forget everything you knew at that point, right? So the idea here is that you've forgotten everything you learned from your previous lives. And the moral content of the idea is that your character is a function of habit from all of your previous lives, not rational choices that you make in your one life. That's the Platonic doctrine. Goodness is the result of bringing to mind the wisdom learned in past lives and the underworld. This is Virgil's reworking of Plato's doctrine of recollection, as it's known to Plato scholars, the doctrine of recollection. Okay? And here's that word, anamnesis. In a beautiful 18th century French neoclassical sculpture called Anamnesis. Here she is. She's at the Lethe River. And she's scooping out the water. And she brings it up. And you can see he's captured in marble what forgetfulness looks like. I mean, if you're drinking something and you forget everything, you forget you're drinking it. So what do you do? You just keep drinking it. It's like a person that's had one or five too many. They just forget it and they keep drinking it and they get really sick. Right? If it's anamnesis. It's the not forgetting. Socratic teaching is a kind of midwifery. This is actually Socrates' phrase. It's a midwifery delivering up by questioning the goodness that has been buried in your soul. Right? The idea is that you've already learned all this stuff from all these lives. When you're reborn, you need to not learn it all anew, but you need to remember what you forgot because you drank from Lethe when you were in the underworld. This is all very interesting, makes for a lot of great poetry, and it's completely pagan. It is not just unbiblical, it's anti-biblical. What does the book of Hebrews say? It is appointed unto men once to die, and after this, the judgment. Right? It's absolutely unbiblical, anti-biblical. So it should be vividly apparent why Christians may rightly and should rightly look askance at a teaching method of such pagan provenance. But let's put this in a theological perspective, okay? In Romans chapter 1, Paul, I'm sure you're familiar with this, says this, "For the wrath of God is revealed," it's a present active participle, constantly being revealed, "from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath shown it unto them." Right? You already know all the basic information that you need to know about God, that there is one, that he is the author and creator of all things, that he is the judge of all things, that he is holy, that he is good, that he is pure, that he is offended with your sin. You already know everything that there is to know about God that you need to know. It is hardwired into you. But what do human beings do? Now, this is the King James translation, which is very beautiful, and I love it. But there are some places where it's not really quite up to modern dictionary snuff. Holding the truth, as you probably know, would best now be translated with suppressed, to hold back, to deny, to cover up, to sweep under the rugs, to pretend you don't know about it, or to forget it, to deliberately forget it. Now, in my book, Meaning at the Movies, I already argued extensively that this passage is a crucial locus for understanding the origins and the nature of human cultural production. I think all human cultural production, from Emily Dickinson to Steven Spielberg, from Plato to Shania Twain, can be understood in terms of the suppression of truth. So if you want to read something like that, you can pick it up at your library and take a look at it. So we could ask, what is the ultimate source for our ideas, our conceptions, our values, our practices, our desires? Paul also addresses this issue elsewhere. Let me kind of move through that one. And let's go to another passage that tends to be very familiar in the circles of classical Christian educators, and that's Acts 17, you know, Paul on Mars Hill, right? Where he's engaging with the pagans, as we like to say. In Acts 17, Paul quotes, apparently from memory, I don't think Paul is carrying his little penguin pocket edition of the classical Greek pagan poets. I don't think he's got that. I think he's read at least some of the poetry in his culture. He knows the philosophy, right? He engages a few verses before he engages the Stoics and the Epicureans, who are the two largest and most influential philosophical groups at that time in Greece. So he apparently quotes from memory several pagan philosopher poets in the well-known words of verse 28, asserting that even their own poets know the core truths about the invisible and immaterial one true God. And then he rebukes the Athenians for producing material idols. In Greek philosophy, God is not matter. He's not material. He's this ethereal being. It's a very Platonic conception. And he says, and yet you represent him with stuff. Right? And so he says things like this. Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship," he sees all the little altars up there. Right? This is the hill that's right across from the Acropolis. Right? Talk about a great sermon illustration. Right? He says, God does not dwell in temples made with hands. You guys see the Parthenon over there? Guess what? It's empty. There's nothing in there. That's like the best sermon illustration ever. They've got the pagan temple right there, and he just points to it. Right? He says, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. See, the Greeks wanted to make sure that with all their gods, their expanding pantheon, because they were syncretists, they absorbed gods from all the different local Mediterranean cultures. And they want to make sure, you know, if we missed one, if we forgot one, we don't want to offend him, her, it, or they, or whatever pronoun you particularly like these days. And we'll just build an altar and call it to the unknown God. And it's just kind of like an empty signifier, and you can just slot yourself in wherever you want, okay? He says, "What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples, Parthenon, made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind." That is the one verse right there that should dismantle any form of racism. Right? "Having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of the dwelling place that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him." He uses, it's almost a Socratic image, of this blind person, blind people, trying to feel and find their way out to God. That's the Pauline image. And it's very interesting because when he works his way through to talk to them, he quotes their poets. He says, "Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said. For we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent." There's no sermon that's complete without that word in it somewhere. That was John the Baptist's one-word sermon, repent. Thank you very much. See you next week, right? That's a sermon right there. Okay? Turn around. Change your attitude. "The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead." Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Now, why would the Greeks mock him for that? The Greeks believe, if you've studied your Greeks, you know they believe in some crazy stuff. Why would they mock him for this? Because in their worldview, who in their right mind would voluntarily be brought back from Elysium to live in a body like this? It's insane. It's insane. It makes no sense. So they mock him for the resurrection, right? What's really interesting here is when Paul quotes, he's quoting the phenomena of this Cilician poet named Aratus, probably Aratus, and the hymn to Zeus by Cleanthes of Assos. And he deploys these two pagan poets, apparently from memory, and he uses the pagan poets to rebuke the current Greek pagans. You guys know, but what are you doing to that truth that you know? You are suppressing it. See, the problem with suppressing anything, it's like think about air. You can compress air. Can you compress water? Water is non-compressible. You really can't compress water. If you put water in a container and you squash it down, it'll blow the gaskets out. Right? And truth is like that. You cannot suppress it for any great length of time. It always comes back. Even Freud knew that. Nietzsche built his entire worldview around the idea of the return of the repressed. So did Freud. Wrong on a lot of things, but right on a few of the important things. And so he says that you should know that God is not knowable through the art and imagination of man. And there's a number of different ways that those words, art and imagination, have been translated. The Greek phrase there, technes kai enthymousios, two feminine genitive singular nouns, sorry, nerd moment, linked by the conjunction kai or and, often translated art and imagination, technes and enthymousios. But that's kind of it's kind of problematic to translate technes as art. It's the root for our word technique, and it's the root for the word technical. And it's a lot more than painting and sculpture and drawing and theater and dance and stuff like that. It's not those things, but it's much more than that. Its sense includes making objects for practical and aesthetic use. But it's not merely material either. It's actually used in Plato's Republic to describe the technique of ruling a city well. We could even maybe call it production in a certain sense, cultural production, whether it's material or non-material, whether it's a statue or an idea like Machiavelli's Il Principe, the prince. The other word up there, translated here, imagination, enthymousios, is also interesting. It's often translated device or thought or invention or design. It's actually used, it's actually the word for thoughts in Hebrews 4:12. The word of God is alive and powerful and active, and it's a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. It's the passions and the thoughts and the drives and the desire of the heart. It's actually very, very rare in classical literature. It occurs here and very rarely elsewhere. It's in Hippocrates, Euripides, Thucydides. It occurs once in Lucian, the satirist. And in those places, it means thought, imaginations, and intense drive or desire. Just think of the romantic conception of an artist. The tortured Beethoven. Right? Okay. There's this intense imagination and this drive and desire to create. I'm married to an artist, so I know that all artists are weird. Right? They're just different. And the church has no idea what to do with artists, by the way. Seems to have no idea what to do with artists, right? Okay? And there's this intense drive and desire to be creative. Right? Now, if we look at what I just showed you in Acts 17 and in Romans 1, that's going to take us to one more place, and that's in the Old Testament. And here's something you may have never looked at or thought about before in terms of human culture. That's Genesis 4, right? Cain knew his wife. She conceived and bore Enoch. When he built a city, right? Cities are always the center of culture, right? The great artist tends not to grow up out in the hinterlands, right? Da Vinci was from the hinterlands, but he went right to Florence, right? Michelangelo is from Florence. Dante is from Florence. Everybody important is from Florence. I teach in Florence all the time. Right? So all the cool people in Florence, I'm not including myself with those guys, but you get what I mean. Okay. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad fathered Mehujael. It happens in the cities. And Mehujael fathered Methushael, and Methushael fathered Lamech. And at this point, most people reading the Bible, they fall asleep. This is so unimportant. And I remember, 33 years ago as a druggie, I picked up the Bible for the first time. I'm going to try and read the Bible. And you get to those genealogies, you're like, why do I care about these dead Jewish people? I can't even pronounce their names. Right? This is actually very important. Not so much the names of the people, but what they did. Because think about what's in Genesis 1, then what's in Genesis 2, and then that really important thing in Genesis 3. And Genesis 4 shows us the results of what happened in Genesis 3. And Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah, and Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. And that doesn't necessarily mean he invented agriculture and, cattle droving, but he's kind of identified as the person who kind of got that whole ball rolling, at least in the Canaanite civilization. His brother's name was Jubal. Now it becomes really interesting. He was the father of all who played the lyre and pipe. This guy seems to be at least identified with the invention, the cultural practice of music. Doesn't mean that no one ever sang or banged a rock before, but this is the guy that really gets it going as a cultural force, right? Jubal, the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe, right? Led Zeppelin can trace their genealogy right back to Jubal. They probably would deny that, but there they are. Zillah also bore Tubal Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. So you've got these two. Some of them become farmers. They're out there working and slaving all day, and they're humming songs that their brother made. And when they come back into the village at the end of the day, after grazing their sheep or whatever they're doing out there, they've got this guy, Tubal Cain, who's the forger of instruments of bronze and iron. So the people who make things, Bronze Age, Iron Age, they're making things out of metal. They're making tools. First of all, you've got to make tools to make more tools. You've got to make a hammer so you can make and then make an anvil. And then you can make forks and knives and cleavers and, maybe jewelry. a couple of cool statues. You stand up the statue and you make music and you dance around the statue. We're talking about idolatry, right? The origin of culture is in and of itself naturally idolatrous. This is where worship originates, right? And this comes from the enthymousios that Paul's talking about in Acts 17. Because human beings have replaced God with nothing, because that's all we have, because we've suppressed the truth of God, we still have that intense desire to worship because we are like machines made to do one thing, and that is to worship God. But since we say no to God, but we still have this intense drive to worship something, we have to worship something, so what do? We make culture and we worship that. Ever been to a concert, a good rock concert? It's a lot like what you wish a worship service would be like in some ways. Ever been to a museum? People are like, wow, I just stand. I was in Venice a week ago, second time this year, and the guards had to tell me to leave. Please, sir, you're blocking the view of Giorgione's The Tempest. Again, you were just here. We told you to leave last month. Leave. This painting, you know, they're like carrying me away from this painting. Because worship is attention. See, man now desperately desires to fill the vacuum formed by the evacuation of God. We desperately desire to fill that. We have the enthymousios, this intense imaginative drive to produce culture, techne, culture which is made, technique, which replaces God. And the replacement is always a partial, watch this, a partial imitation of truth. It's simultaneously accurate because we know the truth and we acknowledge a need for God even while we deny it. And it's blasphemous because it ultimately rejects God as he truly is. And then we suppress his truth. The final lines of Genesis 4 actually complete this picture. Adam and Eve's third son, Seth, produces Enosh. And then we read, at that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. Some of those who were following the one true God saw the idolatrous dancing around the bronze and iron statues for fertility rites in most ancient cultures, right? That ties all of Genesis 4 together. The fertility rites, the bring the crops, let's surrender our kids to Moloch, so on and so forth, right? And they respond by calling upon the name of the Lord. This is the institution of true worship of the one true God. Right? The first kind of the beginning of some kind of formalized worship of the one true God. And it's clearly set over against the idolatrous culture and music and metallurgy of those who can now properly be called pagans. They know the truth, but they've suppressed it. Now, let me try and put all this together for you in terms of Socratic dialogue. My argument is this. Human culture comes to the word cultus, which is related to the word agriculture. It means to dig up, to plow, to prepare for the production of something. Can be traced back to Genesis 4. Romans 1 tells us that we've suppressed the truths, all the truths about God, about his world, even about our own created nature. We suppress those truths, but because we've suppressed those truths, we are left with these longings for some kind of ultimate meaning for something. The saddest thing I ever read was about a woman's dying words. Two words. She died in her late 50s. She said, that's it. That is the saddest thing I've ever heard. Everybody's desperate for meaning. Without God, you can't find it. You can partially replace it with things that are partially true, but you can never fully replace God. This is the origin of culture, the suppression of truth. We've suppressed the truth about God, about his creation. We've suppressed the truth about truth itself, about goodness, about beauty, about our own created nature. We've suppressed the truth about justice. This is why there's so many movies about justice and about vengeance. Right? Everything we suppress, it bubbles back up. It always comes back up like an artesian spring. Because truth is incompressible. You push it down here, it pops up over there. You push it over here, it floods out down there. You can never, ever, ever get away from it. This is the origin of culture, human beliefs and practices that attempt to give our lives grounding and structure and direction. All art comes from suppressed truth, I believe. All human religion comes from suppressed. All religion has a little bit of truth in it. All of our political systems, left, right, middle, way off in left field, right field, wherever. It all comes from this. All of our myths, all of our values, our ethics, all of this comes from suppressed truth, which bubbles back up and forms the superstructure of our culture. And Cicero and Virgil share the Platonic conception that there are things buried within us that need to be unsuppressed. You see that? Even the pagans know there's something in there trying to get out. It's just that their explanation is wrong. Correct diagnosis, wrong ontology. They don't know what's really, they know something's going on, they just don't know what it really is. And that's why I love Plato. Because it's the perfect metaphor. This is my favorite toy when I was a little kid. You get those four little cans of those four colors in there, and it smells vaguely like a biscuit, you know? And so you eat it, and then your mom corrects you, you know, stop doing that, you're too old to do that, you're 12 years old, you shouldn't be doing that. And then they had the Fun Factory, Plato's Fun Factory. Plato's Fun Factory, right? Not the Republic. You put that Play-Doh in there, and you put that little slider in there with the cutout shapes, and you squash it down, and the Play-Doh comes out, and then it's a star or a cylinder or a rabbit or whatever, and you cut it off. Right? See, that's how suppressed truth works. It's still there, but it's been compressed, and it's come out in a different outward form, which I realize is a Platonic description. It comes out in another, but it's still the same thing. And that's where culture comes from, right? Culture is the perversion and reconstitution of the very truth it suppresses. That is the truth that there are, in fact, things that are suppressed. People want to believe that they know themselves. That was what was written on the entrance to the Delphic Oracle, the temple at Delphi, right? Gnote se auton. And then when the Latins came by, nosce te ipsum, know thyself. The entire purpose of philosophy was to know yourself. The only problem was Jeremiah 17:9. Can't do it. Calvin's fabulous metaphor from book one and book two, particularly of the 1559 final version of the Institutio Religionis Christianae, the Institute of the Christian Religion. His metaphor is a labyrinth. He keeps using this phrase, in se descendere, descend into yourself. You descend into yourself. You want to find out what you are, do Greek philosophy, get to know yourself. If you actually descend into yourself, you find that you are a labyrinth. You are your own labyrinth. And what's in the bottom of the labyrinth? The Minotaur, a nasty, incestuous bull man who will eat you. So you don't want to descend too far into yourself. You don't want to find out what you're really like. People don't want to know what they're really like. You do not want to know what I'm really like. You do not want anyone to know what you're really like. You don't even want to know what you're really like. And Calvin uses the same metaphor for God. You can try and descend into God. You will find he's a labyrinth. And then he continues with that great thread from Greek mythology, because Calvin was a classical Christian humanist and he knew the classics as well as anyone in the 16th century. Right? He says, how do you get out of a labyrinth? Ariadne gives you a thread. And for both descending into yourself, which causes you to become lost and eaten by the monster inside of you, and to try to descend into God, which means you are lost in an unimaginable sublime power. How do you get out of the labyrinth? Ariadne's thread. And in both cases, for Calvin, Ariadne's thread is the scripture. It will lead you into yourself and then back out of yourself, and it will lead you into the depths of God. Right. We don't want to believe that we've suppressed anything, but in fact, we've suppressed, yeah, pretty much everything. Summarize it another way and kind of revisualize it a little bit. Big T, that's truth. That's the true truths that God has built into the world. But we suppress that truth and we break it up and chop it up into little pieces like a sushi chef, and it's all over the place, and we mix it up and put it in a blender, and then we turn it into our culture, right? And so every little bit and piece of truth that's left is a mixture of T and F, true and false. And the truths and the falls are always fighting back and forth. This political group, that philosophical group, this religious set of ideas, these ethical people over here. And they're always fighting back and forth. And no one can ever come to a final settled truth because we've suppressed it so fully. But the suppressed truth will always inevitably reemerge. This is what I call the conservation of truth principle. It will always come back. Ultimately, it comes back at the final judgment where every mouth is stopped. Right? And it comes back in culturally variant forms with various flavors of truth. That's why there's a little truth in Plato and a little bit in Virgil and a little bit in Plotinus. And these reemergent truths have been perverted by human depravity, and they've become mixed with the false. And now, according to James, all human wisdom, what he calls earthly wisdom, it now only appeals to the flesh. It accords with demonic forces. Satan is in charge of this world and opposes God. That's what he says in 3:15. Everything in human wisdom is earthly, sensual, and demonic. My guy that I work on for a living, John Milton, has this great line spoken by Jesus in Paradise Regained. All philosophy adds up to subtle shifts, which means gossamer philosophical arguments, subtle shifts, conviction to evade. All philosophy is nothing but an attempt to convince yourself that you're better than you actually are. That's all it is. That's all it is. Romans states that what can be known of God is built into man by God himself. He hardwires this core knowledge about his existence, his nature, and his workings into all of us. This knowledge is not a salvific understanding or any kind of saving faith. And in any case, it's rejected. The primary effect of this knowledge is to remove the possibility of excuse from the unrepentant soul, so no one can claim, "But I didn't know about God." That's why he says that every mouth will be stopped there in Romans. Because humans are by nature lost in sin, the response to this built-in knowledge of God is the act of suppression. Humans are actively, continually forgetting the knowledge of God. Well, this brings about a very interesting little conundrum. How do you deliberately forget something? Do you remember anything that you learned? Do you remember anything that you learned in eighth grade? Do you remember anything you learned in eighth grade? Try to forget it now. See, the act of trying to forget requires that you remember to forget, which means you recall it. The act of suppression necessarily brings to mind the very subject that's being suppressed. In other words, suppression or deliberate forgetting is doomed to failure because you have to remember to forget. And so you end up in this kind of an infinite loop. And that's not the only thing that is suppressed either. You also suppress the fact that you're suppressing the truth. You tell yourself, "All I want to know is the truth. Hey, tell me the truth. Truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth." No, that's not what you want. But that's what you say you want because it sounds good. The act of suppression itself must be forgotten, denied, and suppressed. And then you have to forget that you suppressed that. Then you got to forget that you suppressed that. Then you got to forget you suppressed that. And then I'm going to run out of places to stand up here. So that's why human beings are always working in a circle. The remembrance reverses the forgetting. Suppression requires suppression. And so human beings end up in this terrifying loop from which we cannot escape. We're aware of God and His commands. We suppress this knowledge. The suppression is ineffective because we can neither forget the suppression nor entirely escape the truth, because truth is blasting at us from every angle at every moment of our lives. This set of circumstances is unbearable, and so the only answer that we have is more suppression. This is why people basically spend their lives self-anesthetizing, whether it's art or drugs, sex, whatever it may be. Unregenerate humans are trapped in a suppression whirlpool unless released by what? Conversion. And if you are a Christian teacher, that is your lesson plan. Not Virgil. Not Latin gerundives. Not Singapore math. Conversion. That is what you are aiming at for your kids. Your discipline is just the tool you use along the way. Unless you are released by conversion, in which case the truth is unearthed and accepted and becomes the transforming agent that sets you free. God needs to knock all of us off of our horses on the way to Damascus. Your job as a teacher is to knock kids off their horses. Until then, truth remains rejected, suppressed, and forgotten. If this, everything that I've said, if this is in fact an accurate picture of the human condition, then we have a better way to understand the superstructure of ideas supporting the ancient pagan theory and practice of Socratic dialogue. Think it through. Now we're in a better position to strategically utilize this technique of probing, asking, "Are you really sure? Do you know that for sure? How do you know that? Why do you know that? How do you know that you know that? Why do you think that you know that you know that? Why is something good? Why is something true? Why is something beautiful? What is the meaning of life?" We're in a better position to strategically utilize this technique and defend its usage from a theological rather than a merely practical basis. Christians do not believe in multiple reincarnations leading to perfection via recollected knowledge. We believe that the suppressed truth about Christ, when brought back to life in a dead heart, will set you free. Since studying human culture in light of Scripture inevitably shows us what we are, such study can, regardless of the discipline, such study can, when well guided, lead to deep self-knowledge, what the Greeks and the Romans said that they were after. And it always starts with questions. All human culture, even the Socratic Platonic doctrine of recollection, is a kind of tension between the wistful looking back towards a desired but lost Eden and a violent attempt to suppress the truth about that loss. Wise Christian Socratic teaching actually unpacks the tension of suppressed knowledge of God and His world and of our condition. It reveals the truth about ourselves to ourselves. That's what the questioning actually does. It reveals the truth about ourselves to ourselves. The fallen heart is, to quote Martin Luther, cor incurvatus, I'd say, a heart curved back into itself, like Caravaggio's magnificent painting of Narcissus. A Christian Socratic teacher gently unbends the heart by reminding it of the truth, which Christ in Scripture may then unfold from within the recesses of even the most resistant heart. This is why you have your kids read the best stuff. You show them the most beautiful art. You have them listen to the most heart-wrenching music. And you probe and you push and you always leave them uncomfortable. Most teachers think their job is to go into the classroom and solve the problems and answer the question. Stop it! That is not your job. It is to raise the questions and point them to Christ. Christian Socratics brings forth an unforgetting of the forgotten and suppressed truth. And that is why it works so well. The Greek word for truth is, of course, aletheia, not forgetting. For Christians, there is no lethe. Thank you for your time. If you happen to come to my talk on the sublime in the plenary on Saturday morning on Poieletheia and Milton and the making of the not forgetting, you'll see a whole lot of practical examples of this very, very kind of thing. All right. I'll see everybody later.